Please welcome Peter Reinhardt.
Thanks, Mark.
Well, thank you. This is really an amazing turnout. Thank you so much for coming. How many are here for the first time to one of the WFAE forums? Wow. Quite a few first-timers. Wow. Well, welcome. Thank you. How many have been to other forums before? Not so this is with more newbies. And how many were at the one we did at Johnson & Wales 2 years ago? See, just a few. So this program has really grown, and I'm really honored to be a part of it. Thank you all for coming. How many of you heard the other day the little radio essay by Elizabeth Schaefer, the essay that I call now, my name for it is the Bacon Fat Memories story, you know? You hear that? A few of you. Elizabeth's here tonight, so we're going to hear more about that a little bit later, because that's an essay that's worth, if you haven't heard it, hearing it, and there will be a way, I think, for you to actually catch up with that one later on. So there's a lot that we want to share with you, but really the reason we're here, and before I introduce our panel, the reason we're here tonight is to, you know, kind of explore the question, what is Southern cooking, and then and now? And I know that everybody here in the room has an opinion about that. Our panelists have opinions about that. They have information, you do. But let's find out what the man on the street thinks about the question, what is Southern cooking?
Homemade biscuits, cornbread, country-style steak and gravy,
fried chicken, collard greens, pinto beans.
Fattening. Biscuits and gravy, and I'm from the north, so I really don't know. They eat a lot of some kind of beans down here. I don't know what they are, navy beans or some kind of beans.
Grits, gravy. I don't know, maybe fried foods more than, you know, anything else. I lived up north for 19 years, so I would normally think of grits and things like that.
Most people down south call, when they come down south, they said they're coming down south to get Southern cooking. So that could be your fried chicken, your collard greens, potato salad, and mac and cheese.
You want me to be honest? Obesity.
Delicious.
Obesity. Terrible.
Better than Northern cooking.
Better than Northern cooking? Is that what I heard? I'm offended. Better than Northern cooking. Holy cow. I'm from the north. In fact, how many were at my biscuit talk a couple years ago? About a year and a half ago, we did one. Just a few of you, so good, so I can use some of the same jokes. I spoke at the museum here and also up at Davidson on sort of what happens when a northern baker encounters southern baking and southern biscuits. And and what I said then, and just a prelude to us getting going here, is you know as a baker, I think everybody from every region of the country and the world has an allegiance to what they grew up with, the foods of their childhood, of their youth, of where they're from. And so we have a style of cooking for where I'm from. We have biscuits, and we have cornbread, and we have things like that. I'm from Philadelphia, from the Northeast area, North Central and Northeast. I lived in Boston for a long time. They definitely have strong opinions about what they think food is. And I bake, but, you know, I bake bread mostly. I'm known for bread. And I wasn't until recently all that interested in doing biscuits because it wasn't something that was big where I grew up. Most of the biscuits that I remember were kind of dry and uninteresting. So when I moved down here, the first thing that happened was my next door neighbor came over to introduce herself to me, and she found out that I was a baking instructor, and she said, "Do you do biscuits?" And I said, "Well, you know, I can make biscuits." And she said, "Because I just want you to know, I'm known in this neighborhood as the biscuit queen." And basically she's saying there's only room for one biscuit, you know, person, you know. So I said, "Hey, you can have that franchise. I won't go up against it." And it turns out she brought us some biscuits a couple days later, and they were awesome. They were fabulous. They really convinced me that there is such a thing as a good biscuit. And then the other thing that I run into a lot as, the main thing that I hear whenever I talk about the food that I like is the main comment I get is, "You're not from around these parts, are you?" And the one where I get it the most is when I do cornbread, because cornbread is very different in different parts of the world also. And I love sweet, moist, creamy kind of cornbread. And I'm seeing that people, no. So if you want to start a fight with somebody down here, you talk about, you know, you can say, what's the real cornbread? My brother-in-law lives in Colombia, and he just can't stand the cornbread I like. He likes, you know, it his way, which is a drier biscuit-like cornbread. And again, when I, you know, you're not from around these parts, if that's the way you like cornbread. So that's what I deal with all the time. But I have learned to make biscuits that I think, again, in my style, but in a way that I think works for people from down here. So at the end of the night, we have a box of biscuits at the back of the room. Everyone can get it. I think I made enough for everyone to get one. And they're small little biscuits, just a little bite. Of course, they're not as good as they were, you know, 4 hours ago when they came out of the oven. But see what you think. And they're made with butter, and I'll remind you at the end of the night to grab a biscuit on your way out. And of course, at the end of the evening, we can hang out for a little bit and talk informally as well. But let's get on with it. Let's find out what our panelists have to say. So let me introduce. First, I'm going to tell you who all three of them are, and then we'll come back and we'll sort of get the ball rolling. So right to my left, many of you are familiar with and have read Heidi Bellotto's column for, you know, years and years, her reviews, restaurant reviews. She's a writer now Charlotte Living Magazine. Every issue has at least, I don't know, this always seems like two or three articles by Heidi in there. She runs that food section over there. She's been on the radio a lot. She teaches classes all around Charlotte. When I first met her, she was Heidi Edidin. Some of you might remember her as Heidi Edidin. And now she's married to Tom and Heidi Bellotto. And so if you find Heidi, you're usually going to hear some good music also, because right. Tom's a great musician. So we're honored to have Heidi here, and she's got a lot of perspective for us. And we'll come back to you in a few minutes. Penny Craver at the end of the row. Many of you have eaten at her restaurant. How many of you have been to Dish? Wow. Fantastic. All right. So we got the Penny fan club here. She's the co-owner and general manager of Dish. And that's not too far from here. It's right in the Plaza Midwood area. Her stated goal was to alleviate a perceived lack of good Southern cuisine on restaurant menus in this part of town. And in addition, she's viewed Charlotte's cultural scene through many lenses, not just through food. Some of you may remember the Tremont Music Hall in the 90s. She was the manager for that venue for what, 10 years or so, right?
Yeah, 10 years.
So she's also kind of have her finger on the pulse of a lot of cultural things going on here. And finally, Denise Hairston, who you may have heard Denise when she was on Charlotte Talks. Jeez, when was it? About a year and a half ago. We did a whole show on soul food. And Denise took the challenging position of defending soul food as a vegetarian cuisine. She's our vegetarian soul food expert. So she's a culinary expert, an author. She has written a number of books, and a health advocate. And as a child, she learned from her mother how to prepare real down-home soul food. And she owned her own vegetarian restaurant in St. Louis. She's been a vegetarian for 20 years, the author of Meatless Soul Food Cookbook. And so she'll tell us a little bit more about that. She's also an accomplished public speaker. She's been on television a lot. She's presented all over the place, and she's here to join us as well. So thank you, all three of you, for coming tonight and sharing your expertise with us. So I guess we'll start. Let's start with just sort of the basic question, you know, like, what is Southern cooking? And is there a definition? You know, somebody want to just start with that one, and we'll see where it goes. We're going to throw the floor open to you in a bit for questions as well. We'll let the panel get started. In fact, let's do this. Let's each of them just tell us, you know, make maybe a few minute statement of which part of this conversation, you know, you have some opinions on. Okay. Go ahead. We'll start with Heidi.
I'll go ahead and start. I like Peter. I was born in the South in Florida, but I was born to a mother from Boston and a father from Chicago. And Russian grandparents, so we didn't eat much Southern. My mother had no idea how to cook a pork chop. And we ate food that my parents grew up eating. So it wasn't until I came to Charlotte in 1975 that I really started to develop an understanding for Southern food. And when I came to Charlotte in 75, I came to go to school, but I've been here ever since. And Charlotte was not a culinary city. There were no restaurants. There were lots of restaurants, but there were no fancy restaurants. Most of them were family-owned meat and threes. Do you all know where you could get meat and three vegetables? And always banana pudding was a vegetable on the, and that's what there were everywhere. And you couldn't get a pizza delivered. You couldn't, I mean, there was just nothing more than that. And so Charlotte has obviously come a very long way. And in the time I've been here and have been writing about food and teaching cooking classes, and what I've seen in terms of restaurants is that we went from all those family-owned meat and threes, most of which were owned by Greek families, interestingly enough, and some other soul food kind of just down-home cooking to all of a sudden, every steakhouse came to Charlotte. Every big chain came to Charlotte. But what's happened now is that we've got a lot of restaurants, and like these two women have done, where we have Southern ingredients, but all done with sort of a chef's eclectic twist on American cuisine, but using Southern ingredients. So now instead of this glob of grits on your plate, there's a grit cake with foie gras on top of it, and, you know, a pork belly instead of bacon, and so things have just gotten much more sophisticated and healthier as a result of that. I mean, I think a lot of soul food restaurants in Charlotte have gone to using turkey bacon and turkey fat rather than a lot of pork products. And a lot of restaurants in Charlotte, as you and I have talked about many times, are moved now to using more local ingredients. Yeah. So we have local pork, which is just healthier, just in and of how it's raised and produced, and a lot of organic products, and vegetables aren't cooked forever and ever. So that's kind of what I've seen happen here. So that's the then and the now, and I think we're moving in the right
direction. I'm just really excited to hear you say that foie gras is a healthy food, because that's...
Well, I don't know that I exactly said that.
It made my day.
Yeah. But I'm willing to go out on a limb and say that. Yeah, yeah. So that's kind of how... And I think the same... I brought some cookbooks, too, because I write about cookbooks, but... And we can talk about that a little bit later, but the same things happened. I mean, you know, Southern food across the country has gotten to be real trendy, and it's the hot thing. And so, like, biscuits and grits and gravy and all of that is sort of a real trendy, chic thing to be eating.
Thank you. Denise.
Thank you. I think that, I know that I grew up in Tennessee. My mother and my father both were from Tennessee. And I actually, I moved to St. Louis, Missouri when I was very young, so I really grew up in Missouri. But that old Southern way of cooking, I grew up with that. We visited my grandmother every year when we went to St. Louis. We went back every year to Tennessee to visit. And every morning for breakfast, we spent the summers with my grandmother. And every morning for breakfast when we got up, this was breakfast, we had fried chicken, rice, gravy, biscuits, bacon, and some ham and eggs. This was breakfast. And so, good thing there was not childhood obesity back then. And it's because we had to walk every place, and we had a lot of exercise because we walked. But that was just breakfast. And that's what I grew up being used to. And my mother, taught me how to cook, and my grandmother how to cook the traditional soul food or Southern food, which I enjoyed. I always loved cooking. And I grew up, since I could reach a stove, doing that and wanting to do that. And then I got into wanting to, you know, I took a few culinary classes just as an interest, not to go and be a chef. And then about 23 years ago, I started looking into healthier ways of eating the traditional soul food and Southern food, because I saw a lot of things around me, unhealthy people who had a lot of chronic illnesses and things like that. And I would read and study that these things were related to what we were eating. So I started thinking, you know, we got to start changing this. So I started with myself. But I said that, and I was the cook in the family. Remember, in my whole family, I had a large family. It was 8. And so I was like the cook in the whole family after my mother and my grandmother. And so people would say, well, you can't stop eating meat because you're like the chef of the family. You have to cook the greens and the macaroni and cheese and the chicken and dumplings and all of that and the pork chops for us. And so I said, I know, but, and as Peter said, you recreate them. So I started recreating the traditional Southern food and the way it was prepared, and started preparing it in a healthier way. And that's how I got on my quest to, you know, as I would eat healthier and find things, I didn't want to give up the taste. I love the taste of good Southern food, and I still do today. I love the traditional Southern food, the way it tastes and the way it feels in your mouth and all of that. But I just don't like what it does to your body in terms of health. And so I started changing the way I prepared my own foods, and I started changing the way I prepared the foods for my family, and they started loving it. And so I started with that. And you take, instead of just, you know, being a vegetarian, instead of just putting smoked turkey in the greens, I say, why don't I show you guys how I can stir fry these collards and put some sun-dried tomatoes in them and some onions and some olive oil, and you'll love them. And they did. And so now at family gatherings, I'm the one who does all the vegetables so that I can eat them and they can eat them and they love them. So, you know, I consider Southern food is not just the ingredients. I think it's the ingredients, but it's also the way the food is prepared and, you know, the types of things. It's the food that you make, but fried chicken doesn't just have to be the traditional way of fried chicken that we have and the green, the collard greens and all of that. It doesn't have to be exactly the way we thought of it from a long time ago, but you can recreate it and make it much, much healthier. And that's what I've been able to do. And when I opened the restaurant with the vegetarian cuisine, that's what we did and people loved it. And I said, okay, this is something good. So I have created meatless soul food and people love it. I've never done, and I do cooking classes all over, especially in Charlotte. I've never done a class where people did not love the vegetarian greens, the vegan mac and cheese, and the tofu banana pudding, and the chickenless dumplings that I prepare.
And you're making vegetarian food, but that is enjoyed by non-vegetarians.
Exactly,
like.
Non-vegetarians are loving the vegetarian soul food. So, I mean, it's just and I'm keeping within my mom and my grandma's tradition of having good tasting food. And the three things I want to wrap up with that we are looking for in our traditional Southern food and soul food is fat, salt, and sugar. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to tell you guys later how we can get all those and still have it healthy.
Great. Thank you. Well, Penny, you've got a restaurant where you're actually showcasing Southern food. While you're answering, you know, speaking to what you were, could you also speak a little bit to the question of is Southern cooking and soul food one and the same thing?
I don't think so. Traditionally, you would consider soul food more African American, and Southern food just, I guess, non-African American. Stuff that you grew up in the South, but I really want to give my take on what I think Southern food is, if that's okay.
Sure.
I have a few notes, so pardon me, but just to give you a little background, my mother is from Westfield, which for those North Carolina, which if you don't know where that is, it's between Mayberry and Mount Pilot. Literally. It's between Mount Airy and Pilot Mountain, and they were tobacco farmers, and I would go up there every summer and help prime tobacco. And, you know, at that big, you know, 35 cent, 50 cent an hour that I got, and saved some money from the summer. And they have obviously grew their own food. So when I think of Southern food, I think of food that, for the most part, then you grew yourself. It was food that could be grown out in your backyard, your farm, and your garden. So I think of food that, in my grandmother's case, that a lot of stewed food, because she could put it on, leave it, go into and work into in the fields for a couple of hours, and it would be cooking while she could do that. I was thinking about the fried food, and I think that a lot of Southern food is fried because you had the stewed that was cooking while they were in the fields, and then she would leave about 30, 45 minutes before lunchtime, and she would fry because that was quick. That was a quick way of fixing things. So I also think I associate Southern food with a lot of love, and it's simple food. It's not. My grandmother had sage, salt, pepper, cinnamon. I think that's about the only herbs and, well, she didn't have any herbs, spices that she have that she had. And even today, I have salt, pepper, and cinnamon in my house. That's about it. And although I'm the eater, not the cooker, I'm the eater, obviously, but. But that's what I associate with Southern food. And also, because the South was not industrialized, you had to grow your own. You couldn't go to the corner market necessarily to get fresh food and vegetables. So, and then also it was in the basically Southern food, Southerners were relatively poor. And my mother shared with me like the 500th, no, there's about 15 things that when they, fattened a pig that they could get out of one pig. And it would, let's see, some of the things bacon, ham, sausage, fatback, pork tenderloin, liver pudding, crackling. And then they cooked out the fat and that was lard. So that's what I associate with Southern food. So now I forgot the original question you asked me.
You answered the original question too. Yeah, thank you.
And I think we'll continue to talk about that. I know we did a show, and some of you heard it, on soul food a couple of years ago, and one of the guests called in an author, an anthropologist named Fred Opie, who was addressing this question of soul food and versus Southern food. And I said the same thing. That soul food itself as a term, you know, is really a modern term. It's something that came out of the 60s, right?
Right.
Isn't that right?
Exactly.
And it was sort of an out of the, political, situation that was going on then. And it became a way of sort of, creating a sort of a framing around food from the African American community that was primarily Southern influence. So in a sense, you could say that Southern food and soul food is essentially the same food,
right,
but just with a different framing device around it. But now, over the years, that word, that term soul food, has really worked its way into the vernacular to mean a whole lot more than what it originally started out to be. Yeah, did you, before you say what you're going to, let me just mention that, how many of you listen to the news on WFAE regularly? Yeah. So you all know the voices of Tina Simmons and Greg College. So they're going to be our mic runners today. So you get to see them in person. And Tina, you've got a mic for this woman. You want to comment on that?
You were asking about the difference between, and if there was a difference, but you did, speak on it directly, between Southern cuisine and soul food. And so let's take Penny's hog. That's Southern cuisine. African Americans put a little swagger on that, and we get chitlins out of that. We get pig feet out of that we can pickle, boil. We might even do pig ears out of that. So that's the little swagger, that little extra boost that African Americans get, that extra out of that. That makes that hog soul food.
And the brains.
In addition to Southern cuisine.
And the brains.
Yes, the brains, they'll do for cows everything. And we have special names for that in the South. The sweet bread, I think it's called.
All right, great. Thank you for that. So with that said, you know, we have two microphones, we've got runners, we've got the opportunity for you to chime in with questions or comments for our panel. Anybody wanna throw one out? Yeah, sure, thanks. Well, let's get the mic down. Tina, we're ready for you again. Right over here, please. Lard.
I grew up in the West, and I grew up cooking Mexican a lot. And we used lard for Mexican cooking, and I came here thinking, great, I'll get lard anywhere I want. I can't find lard except at Compadre Foods, and I can get the giant 5-pound or 10-pound bucket at Food Lion. Why can't I find lard in the grocery store? Do y'all know?
Want to challenge it?
I don't have
anybody have an opinion? Do you use lard at the restaurant?
No. But it's supposed to be so bad for you.
Right.
I mean, you know, but God, we all grew up watching those Loretta Lynn and Crisco. I mean, you know.
So you can't make pie.
So,
And I think that's the reason that we can't find it, because the whole, not just the country, but the world is going towards health, healthier eating, healthier living, lifestyle change. So, if it's not popular, the stores are probably not gonna sell it as much, just like they're selling more vegetarian things because it's more popular than it used to be. So you won't be able to find lard a lot of places because a lot of people are not wanting to use that anymore.
And it's interesting, too, about lard that even though it is a solid fat and it's not certainly not health food, it's certainly no worse for us and maybe actually more digestible than margarine,
yes,
than butter, than other fats. And we got Elizabeth who spoke directly about it on her essay. So
than butter and lower in calories per tablespoon.
And very few people know that.
Yeah.
It is not used as often as it used to be, but it was a mainstay of Southern, what I think of as Southern cooking, is that lard was the fat of choice because it was available to, people who couldn't afford to buy butter and margarine didn't even exist. And so it was the fat that came out of the harvesting of the pigs. Now it's actually, one of the problems now, in terms of getting it, is that it's not just rendered fat, but it's not just the fat from any part of the pig that's lard. True lard is actually the highest quality fat. It's the fat that's around the organs, inside the pig. So it's kind of like, right now one of the, diet rages is called the belly fat plan, It's the stuff, it's the fat inside that we don't see, and it's actually of a higher quality. It is harder to find, but people have shied away from it because they perceive it to be something. But also we're trying to move away from working, cooking and eating a lot of highly saturated fats, which
I wonder
it is.
If you couldn't get it for, you know, with, again, going kind of back to local food, with so many local pork producers, like the girls at Grateful Growers.
Yes, they have it.
I think that's a good resource. And go on their website. It's ggfarms.com. Do you get it there, Marilyn? I mean, do you, yeah.
Yeah, let's get you on the mic so everyone can hear this.
Grateful Growers sells a different kind of lard than the lard that's good for high-risk and stuff like that. And I'm not talking about using mass quantities of lard. I'm talking about using, I mean, look, you guys, you bakers know, there is nothing like lard for baked goods. And you can mix up lard and butter and, you know, kind of get it to work. And I was just really surprised moving here, not being able to find it. Compare Foods, under Manteca. And they also sell, you know, like home-rendered stuff, but it's not the quality But I was just surprised that you can't get it at Harris Teeter or at Lowe's or at Philo.
Ultimately, it boils down to whether it's selling or not. For stores like that, they don't care. They don't really care whether they have it or not. If you will buy it and there's enough of you to buy it, they would carry it. But which tells you sociologically that it's not being used. How many people in here are still cooking with lard?
Maybe I'm the only one.
A few hands, but you see, but how many of you are cooking with saturated fats, with shortening? Shortening has kind of gone out of fashion. Now all the restaurants have done away. We at Johnson & Wales have just done away with all of our, you know, trans fats. So we've changed all our recipes, and restaurants have done that because the knowledge has come out, the information has come out, and it's now irrefutable. So there is a big dietary change, a paradigm shift going on. So those kinds of fats have gone out of fashion, and yet we all know that, you know, the first thing the bakers say when we heard that the recipes were being changed was, how can we make them as good when we don't have the right kind of fat to work with? Mm-hmm. Well, we found ways to do that. But yeah, so you can see that the demand isn't there the way it once was.
I've seen lard in Latino grocery stores.
Yeah. Campari is an example of one that specializes in those kinds. And so you can still get it. It's just like people ask me, why can't I buy fresh baker's yeast to make bread? It's because it's perishable and it doesn't sell enough for the stores to make money on it. Mm-hmm. But it's still available if you know where to look. But it sounds like not that many of you are actually looking for it, which is a very interesting thing to think about.
I don't mean to sound ignorant, but is lard and Crisco the same thing?
No. Crisco is a vegetable shortening that was created essentially to perform like lard. It's a processed vegetable oil that has been hydrogenated mechanically to solidify so that it has the same kind of cooking properties as a natural fat like lard. It starts out natural, but by hydrogenating oil, which means it actually saturates the oil with hydrogen atoms that fill in the gaps in the molecules that make it liquid, it makes it solid. And as a result, it's also much harder for your body to break it down. But the positive side from a cooking standpoint is it's very easy to work with when you're making biscuits and pie doughs and things like that because it makes everything flaky.
So what do you use now instead of lard or
Crisco? Well, that's a good question.
That's what I'd like to know.
That's a very good question. What do I use personally? Yeah. Oil. I use vegetable oil. And we change the cooking techniques, the actual baking techniques of how we introduce the fat to the product, because you have to do it differently when you're working with liquid oils. Mainly because, again, oil itself is still fat, but it's easier for the body to process that fat than it is a hydrogenated fat. Your body just can't do it, and so it ends up getting stored. Denise, what do you substitute for lard?
I do, to use the fat, I use vegetable oils, but I usually use olive oil in cooking a lot of the vegetables that I use, and it's a technique in cooking the soul food meatless. Instead of what old Southern cooks do and soul food cooks have done, is you have a pot, and you boil a pot, and then you throw in the meat, the fat back, and into the pot so that the flavor can jump off the meat into the boiling water, and you boil that for a long time, and then you throw those vegetables in there. And instead of doing that, what we do for meatless soul food is we start out with the same pot,
But you put some olive oil in there, and you put the vegetables in there, and the onions, the peppers, the garlic, things like that, and then you stir fry up those vegetables. You don't throw vegetables in a pot of water, and that's what you dilute all the taste, you dilute the flavor, and you do everything. You have to cook it so much longer. And so I don't use the lard in, and in terms of baking, I'm baking with things where I can use the canola oils and things like that. And if I can just back up a second in terms of the soul food, the soul food is compared to southern food. Soul food was really African Americans who back in slavery times had to these were foods that they had to eat. They had to make do based on what they had. So they took the foods like the pig, and they took every part of it because the slave master only gave them certain parts. They didn't give them the good parts. And so they made something out of pig feet, pig ears, and then the lard, and they used all of that. And a lot of things were fried because that's the only way they had to cook, to prepare foods. They didn't have the pot and the boil. They could have put water in there to boil, but they fried because it was quick and easy. And the types of foods that they were eating, not just the pig, the parts of the pig, but the possum and the coon and then the fish that they found, that was the best way to prepare it. And using it with a lot of seasonings, which is a part of soul food, the seasonings and the way you season it, putting a lot of seasonings on it to make those lower cuts of meat taste good. And so that's where it came from. And then that same southern food that African Americans were doing, and then people, and they were from the South, and people in the South, and everybody learned how to cook the same way because we were all together. And that same southern food, which is soul food, got the name, like you said, Peter. The name soul food became popular in the 60s, and they start calling it soul food because they related to African Americans. So the way we cooked the food is why it's called soul food, but it is still southern food in terms of the way everybody in the South cooks.
That's excellent. Thank you. How many of you here consider yourselves Southern cooks?
I do.
Okay. And how many of you here are from the South, you know, born and raised? A lot more. So many of you who are born and raised here don't cook in what we're kind of describing tonight as Southern style. How would you characterize those of you who don't cook Southern? How would you characterize your cooking? Is it more like what Heidi was saying? Is it bad cooking? Some say bad cooking.
Yeah, the question may be, do you cook?
Do you? Yeah, that is probably the better question. How many people don't cook here? But only a few.
No,
many of you do cook. Well, that's good. That's encouraging. You don't cook.
No, I don't cook.
You're the eater.
I apologize for confusing lard and Chris Hooker because they used them my grandmother used them interchangeably.
So you create the venue where cooking takes place.
I'm the taster.
Yeah, exactly. So it's some interesting sort of themes.
You know what else I think is interesting too, just given what Denise just said about how is the recipes that came from what started out as the lesser part of the pig, you know, what we had to make do with. I mean, that's what Brunswick stew is. And think about every place that sells Brunswick stew now, and we all love it, and every place in the South claims to have invented it, and, you know, it's a big fight over Brunswick stew and you know, other barbecue-y kinds of things. And then we have all these great regional things like liver mush. And, I mean, you can't buy liver mush outside of a little region, not just a little bit north of Charlotte. So it just isn't available.
When I grew up, I could get liver mush, but we didn't call it that. We called it scrapple.
But scrapple's right? A different thing.
Is it a different thing?
It's not the same thing.
I think it has something
to do with the inclusion or exclusion of pig snouts. I'm not really sure about that. Liver pudding and scrapple they look the same, but they're three different things. And you can't find liver mush comes from around Shelby, and you can't find it anywhere else. Tom and I take liver mush to friends in Florida all the time because you can't, it's just not available. That developed from those long time ago recipes.
I love the flavor of those, and maybe because I grew up with scrapple, I didn't have a problem. I know a lot of people. How many of you don't eat liver mush and find it to be sort of an offensive food? Interesting, you know. These are kind of cultural issues. If I had asked that question 20 years ago, I think fewer hands would have gone up because many people, you know, grew up with that and maybe liked it. Or maybe you grew up with it and hated it so much that you refused to eat it now. I don't know. I find it pretty tasty myself, you know. But it just shows you, you know, how we have all these different associations, and I think they're kind of some of the things you're touching on have a lot to do with the associations, either from where we're from, you know, how we learn to cook, also what we see going on in the food world today with regional cuisine, and Heidi really touched on this, that you know, that we have a region that has very distinct food concepts associated with it, whether it's low country cuisine or, you know, the coastal cuisines, and these are queens. What's happening nationally, just to give the national perspective, is that these other regions have their own cuisines. We have the cuisine, the Pennsylvania Dutch style is sort of the Philadelphia thing, California cuisine, Midwest cuisine, Heartland cooking. All these regions are very proud of these styles, and what's happened with the advent of the culinary boom of the last 25 and 30 years is that chefs are being trained in classical techniques that are, whether they're French, Italian, Asian, Mexican, these cooking techniques are now available all over the country and all over the world, and what they're doing is applying those methods to the foods of their region. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, in a way, that's what Denise said she's doing too. You're applying cooking techniques to the foods of your memory, recreating childhood memories, right, so to speak, with flavors, but doing it in a more healthy way. And this is what's going on. There's a lot of reinvention happening. And I think that maybe that's why it's such an interesting subject to us, because we all have a different idea of what, you know, food means to us. And that's one of the deeper questions under all this is, what is the meaning of food in our lives? And, I, you know, I'm hearing a lot that has to do with memory.
And Peter, Southern food would be equal to soul food, would be equal to comfort food, which a lot of different cultures have what would be called soul food, their own soul food. Mm-hmm. And it's really their own comfort food. And so it's just the names that we've given the Absolutely. Same types of things that we all eat, love, and enjoy.
Very good point. Question over here. We're starting to lay sort of a foundation of ideas, and I would love for you to just spring off of them. And whether you have a thought that you want to share or a question for the panel, feel free to join in.
I just had, like, two questions. Do people still salt, like, ham and ham hocks like a smokehouse, and then what about the different ways you can cook squash, like fried squash and rutabagas and things like that? Thank you.
Anybody want to tackle that?
Do people still, you could still buy ham hocks and smoke, I mean, so is that your question? Are they still available?
I'm talking about salting ham hocks like in a smokehouse, hanging it up in a smokehouse.
Yeah.
Do they still salt ham? And I want to know, what is the benefits of salting ham that way? Thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know what I think the benefits of doing it were more as a preservative to make it last a longer time. I don't know that it has a lot of health benefits, but it tastes good. But I think it was a preservative kind of thing.
Do you serve ham hocks on the menu at the restaurant?
No.
It's because I've associate smoked ham hocks also with Southern food. And I love it because it's smoky. You know, who doesn't love smoky foods? Kathleen Purvis did a story in the Observer about a year and a half ago, following the course of a pig from being raised to harvest, and also went to the smokehouse. There aren't too many authentic smokehouses left, which is part of your question. But there are a few, and one was out in the western part of the state. Which was? I think it was Van Hoy Smokehouse. And they're doing sort of the old traditional methods. And we had them on the radio, and they talked about how hard it is. The reason there's not too many is it's hard work. It's really hard to do it right. And so many things can go wrong because you're dealing with natural processes. The weather can change things. So it's a very difficult thing. And it was. And like Heidi said, originally it existed because there was no such thing as refrigeration. So you couldn't preserve food, so you had to use pickling, salting, and things like that as a way to preserve a food, and cooking methods, in a sense, came out of that. Aging meats that way became a way of preserving the meats and became less necessary as technology stepped in. Unfortunately, you know, some of these great methods of preserving food have sort of faded away because it's a hard way to make a living. But there are a few people that do it well. Certainly the Virginia smoked hams are doing well. So they still exist, but they are a dying art, and that's very true. Was there another? I saw some more. Just go ahead. Why don't you guys just follow the hands and take the mics, and whoever gets the mic first gets to talk. We got one here.
May I do two? Sure. One's conceptual. Is Southern cooking, you say then and now, is it possible for there to be a contemporary Southern cooking, or is it just a recreation as best we can in what was then, Or if there is a contemporary Southern cooking, could you tell me what defines it? Secondly, Peter, I'd love to know a little bit about your evolution in your biscuit thing, because as a no-need baker, you know, I kind of dig that. I'm just wondering, where did you start and where'd you end up?
We'll come back to the biscuit one. Let's bring that one up. It's closer to the when we break, because I'll touch on that for sure. But Heidi, why don't you started talking about this?
I think there's absolutely contemporary Southern cooking. I think what's happened is a lot of chefs, talented chefs and well-trained chefs, have sort of gone back to those old roots and found those guys who make chitlins, who smoke ham hocks, and have gone and learned how they've done it and picked up that art. And then come back and, you know, are taking that basis. Like at the Liberty, Tom Condren is from England. He's sort of adapted Southern cooking, and he makes, fried pork rinds. And he learned how to do it from two guys in the back of a pickup truck, you know, on the North Carolina coast. And so,
how many of you have had those pork rinds? Any of
it? They're delicious.
It's worth the trip to get them.
But they're not that greasy, like what I used to think about pork rinds being, and I would have never, you know, the stuff you get in a bag and that are just not very good. But I think that's what's happening. I think people are going back to the roots, taking, maybe not, I said earlier about taking Southern ingredients and putting an eclectic twist on it, but I think they're trying to recreate some of those recipes because people love them, and like Denise said, they love them, they just want them to be healthier. And so that's what now these very talented chefs are trying to do. The bad thing about having a recipe with lard in it that you got from your grandmother and trying to make it with Crisco is what Peter said is so true. You have to reformulate that recipe. Well, if you don't know how to reformulate a recipe and you just try to substitute, not going to work. So we've got this talent, this culinary talent in Charlotte who is doing that, who is making these same flavors, these same mouthfeel, you know, all the things that you miss when you take away fat and salt and sugar, but making it taste good. And that's a real talent to do that. So I think that's really the sign of contemporary Southern cuisine. I mean, maybe it's what you do.
I totally agree with what you said. I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
I think meatless soul food is contemporary Southern cuisine, and I totally agree with what you just said on how to do it. Yeah.
How about you, Penny?
Well, I think that in some cases, now that we have designer Southern food, you know, it's not mac and cheese, it's three cheese macaroni. And now instead of 50 cents a serving, it's $4.50 a serving. And, you know, you can't have grits anymore. They have to be something, whatever, ground from somewhere, and they have to have blue cheese and basil and something in them. So, in a way, it's, you know, it can be considered a bastardization of it. But for me, you know, and it's Southern and people are appreciating it, so I can handle it. But it's a little too complicated for me, taste-wise. But
so does your menu feature essentially more authentic or traditional versions of the foods?
Well, what we've done is we've tried to take traditional things and make them as healthy as possible and still have flavor, which sometimes I'm not being the cook that you are, not being the cook at all. But, I mean, people still want chicken and dumplings, country fried steak, you know, with just gravy, and instead of some other whatever, you know, they want gravy. They don't want something healthy. They want gravy. So, but we try to do as healthy. For our vegetables are all vegetarian prepared, and there are little tricks that you can do, as you know, that make them healthier, and they still retain close to the taste. For instance, we have our collard greens. I had an argument with a vegetarian the other day. He said, those do have meat in them. And I said, I swear they do not. Yes, they do. And he was very mad that I had tried to serve him meat. So, in our collard greens. But
so that was a compliment in a way.
In a way it was. That's the way I took it. Yeah. So,
very well done. Another question over here.
The last time I was in New York City, a friend of mine said, oh, I'm so glad to see you again. I've got an afternoon planned. I'm taking you for barbecue. And I said, can we go get, like, pizza, maybe? No, this is the best barbecue you'll ever had.
Oh, those are fighting words.
And I had to be very nice and say, no, it really isn't. Southern cooking seems to have a degree of pride. And I have noted that barbecue has not really come up in this whole process because barbecue is experiencing such a huge resurgence. So I'm wondering if the panel could address the regionalism and the pride, not so much through ingredients, but in terms of history.
Thank you.
I just think barbecue is a national thing. I mean, there's Texas barbecue, there's St. Louis barbecue, there's barbecue in every region. And there are big barbecue competitions in every region. And Memphis in May, and Charlotte's doing a little version of that, the barbecue and blues event that's coming up, yeah. So there's a tremendous amount of pride in barbecue particularly. And, you know, my husband and I were talking when we were driving over here, it's sort of a joke that in the South, barbecue is a noun. It is something you eat. It is not something you go do out in your backyard. And would you agree with that? So I think maybe the reason it hadn't come up yet is barbecue is like a whole other big conversation. It's a whole other story. And there's a bajillion, even in North Carolina, there's probably 5 or 6 different versions of what people think is the best barbecue. It's a real personal thing.
Well, we've got time. We can explore it a little bit.
If you do it correctly, it's very time consuming.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to sleep at my restaurant to put fire on the coals for the pork shoulder and so it can keep cooking. So it's just, with modern techniques, it just doesn't make much sense. And even the traditional barbecue places have gone to electric cookers and things of that nature. So it's just, I don't think it makes much sense to do it much like that anymore, but I sure do enjoy eating it like that.
But at those competitions, that's where you see the guys with the smokers that are out there all night.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a cool thing to...
How many of you plan to go to the one coming up? It's now considered... You know, it's on the circuit. Charlotte's now part of the barbecue circuit. How many of you go to that one? And it used to be called Blues, Brews, and Barbecue. Yeah. Now it's just going to be called Blues and Barbecue. They're dropping the brews. I'm not sure why. I think it's the sponsor, I think, doesn't want to be associated with that part of it. But you'll get to see world champion barbecue people there. It's worth it. Plus, you get to see... Now, what Heidi said that I think is the most important is that barbecue itself... From the more global perspective, is a cooking technique that has been regionally adapted, and we have a style of barbecue that's ours. In North Carolina, they say there's only barbecue, and everything else is just something else. But in Texas, they say the same thing. In St. Louis and in Memphis, they all have their own thing. So ribs are very big in Memphis, brisket's very big in Texas, sausages certain places. You know, everybody has their way of doing it. But pork barbecue, when we say barbecue here, we all know, those of us from, you know, have lived here long enough, know when we say barbecue, we mean a very specific kind of barbecue, and we all have opinions about what's the best way to do it, how long it should be cooked, whether it should have, you know, the Western sauce or the Eastern sauce or the mustard sauce, which is, you know, South Carolina, so that may not count for some of us, but you know what I'm saying? So what's so cool about it is that it's a passionate subject. It's one of those areas that is a great, either a conversation starter or a conversation ender.
It's very close to the passion of pimento cheese. It's the same.
We need to talk about that one for a little bit tonight, too, I think.
But it's, you know, it's a huge topic.
So we got the mic moving around. Who's got the mic now? Here we'll go here. And those of you who have your hands up, we'll get it next. First you, then you. Yeah. Wait, no, let's get her, then you go second.
Thank you so much. We've talked about veggies. We've talked about meat. Let's talk about dessert a little bit here. I love to get your opinion on what's considered a true Southern dessert. In my list, it would be banana pudding with vanilla wafer, pound cake, peach cobbler, bread pudding. I'd love to hear your opinion what you consider a Southern dessert.
My opinion?
Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
You start, Denise.
You just named all of them. Pound cake, banana pudding, bread pudding, rice pudding, then those type, red velvet cake. Those are all the Southern dishes, peach cobblers, those are the southern types of desserts, and I make all of those. I make all of those as a vegetarian way. I make all of those desserts. And you can do it, trust me, honestly.
Can you speak to what are some of the things that make the difference between a good version and a so-so version?
With banana pudding, you cannot have, it can't be liquidy. It has to be really, really thick. The custard has to be very thick. And you have to have the bananas, the cookies have to be a little bit soft. The bananas can't be hard. It has to be the right consistency. And you can't, and it needs to be really room temperature. It doesn't need to be hot, and it doesn't need to be too cold. It needs to be room temperature because that's the traditional, original. Remember when Peter talked about the non-refrigeration from way back in the day? So it needs to be kind of room temperature if you're going to have it just the way it originally was. And so that's something like with that, with the banana pudding. And of course, with the peach cobbler, same thing. You got to have the thick crust. You can't have that. It has to be the crust where it may be like a half inch thick and laid on top. You can't have the little crust that you might have on a pie. So those are the differences. There's some things that you have to taste in the banana pudding and the cobbler and all of the desserts. You have to taste the real vanilla flavor and the real spices and things in there. You have to taste that. It can't be bland. Otherwise, it's not a good southern dessert.
Penny?
And it can't have non-dairy topping in it.
Thank you, Penny.
You know, when I first got here, I wanted to get some barbecue. You know, as soon as I got here, first thing I asked someone who was giving me a little culinary tour of the city, where can we get the best or the most authentic barbecue? And she said, let's go to Bill Spoon's. But she said, make sure you save room for the banana pudding because that's also, so that's sort of like, and she said, this is probably the best banana pudding in town. But then there's other places. You do banana pudding at your restaurant?
Just as a special dessert occasionally.
What are some of the other desserts people might find at Dish?
We do chocolate pecan pie. All of ours are made in-house, by the way. We do a vanilla bourbon sweet potato pie. And North Carolina's the big sweet potato thing, so you've got to have southern sweet potato. And we do a key lime pie. And then we do a sawdust pie occasionally. We do a lot of special desserts.
What's a sawdust pie?
Sawdust pie pretty much it's a pie that tastes like the icing of a German chocolate cake. Coconut, nuts, it's pretty good. It's pretty darn good. It doesn't last very long. It's pretty darn good.
I think there's also, as she was saying them, I kept thinking, yeah, those are distinctively things that you would associate with southern cooking, right? So, and the thing that struck me from the baking side as a baker, they're all, almost every one of them is custard-based. Did you hear that sense of custard? There's custard in the rice pudding, there's custard in bread pudding, and that the key to all these is to really have your custards in shape. Because then a custard is essentially, there's two kinds of custards. A pecan pie is a custard made without eggs, and so we call that a soft custard. But then there's the custards that we mostly know, which is eggs and dairy, eggs and milk. And that is a whole category. Custard is a category of desserts that includes some of the greatest desserts in the world. We're not the only ones who use custard here, but custard is a great dessert category and underappreciated, but a big part of southern cooking, it sounds like, and knowing how to make a good custard is sort of the key to making a great dessert.
Right.
Can I share with you one of my very favorite, what I consider to be a southern dessert? And it actually, well, I love cobblers, and I love any kind of fruit. But this couple sitting in the second row here, this is Marilyn Marks, and her father was Ray Marks, who many of you who were in Charlotte a long time, Ray Marks was a lamp maker and a really cool guy. And he taught me how to make grilled Krispy Kreme donuts. And I just equate that with the South, as Ray was from the South, and you take several day-old glazed donuts and you put them on the hot grill after you've made barbecue chicken with treat barbecue sauce. And you grill them, and what happens is the sugar on the donuts caramelizes, and it smells like cotton candy, and it's the most fabulous thing you'll ever, you know. So I'm just
anybody
sharing
besides
that
Marilyn
recipe.
And Heidi, ever had those? Have you ever had those? You've had them.
What kind of donuts?
Well, fresh.
Oh,
he would take them and slip them in half and then lay the unpowdered part in a frying pan with a little butter.
Oh, yeah.
And they, I still do that now. I mean, they're great.
There's definitely a trend emerging.
Yeah.
It's all starting to come out, little by little. Oh, wait, we see a mic over here. Is there a microphone on the side of the room?
I have two questions. One, I would love to read more about the meat in three restaurants, the history, how they fit in with Southern cooking, so forth. My second question is, where do casseroles fit in Southern cooking? My grandmother never made them, and my mother often does.
Did you have something on that, Penny?
Well, we don't make a lot of them at the at Dish because they're hard to hold, and something that you would make in a large pan like that would have to sit in a steam table or an oven, and it just wouldn't hold very long. So for that reason, unless we made little small dishes, that's the only way we do casseroles. But I consider that more my mother with leftovers than traditional Southern cooking, just myself. So.
Yeah, I don't think it's unique to the South. Casseroles exist in a lot of cultures.
I think it kind of started a lot, too, when canned cream soups became very popular, and then all of a sudden casseroles were born of that a little bit, like tuna noodle casserole. And
interesting, yeah.
I mean, maybe not. Maybe before that. The meat and threes, just to quickly answer your question, are a dying breed, very sadly. There are still some around. There's a great little one in Indian Trail called Trail's End. That must be Monroe Road there, like you're heading into Indian Trail. They're just real small family-owned restaurants, and there used to be lots of them in Charlotte, and lots of them have closed.
Johnny K's
in Indian Trail. If you go to the little towns outside of Charlotte, you'll find more of them. But places like Fresh My Farm and Venus and Athens and lots of those, Athens and Venus and Anderson's, and those are all kind of meat and threes, and they've closed.
There's a new one that opened. It's a little more of an upscale meat and three. Jim Noble, Chef Noble, just opened up the King's Kitchen right in Center City, and I saw in the early review on it that they're doing a meat and three course there. Tom Condren, and when he was at Harper's, tried to do a meet and three at one of the little Harper's ones, and it didn't fly. It just didn't work, which, again, speaks to the fact that we have these sentimental associations with certain ways of eating. I think the one at the church, the restaurant at the House of Prayer.
They
do meet and threes. But we have these associations, but they don't always hold in terms. It's like people love to talk about them, but they don't necessarily go there anymore to eat. Or it's not the way they're eating anymore. So those places.
Yeah, also in Monroe, you're absolutely right. There's a place called the Brown Derby, and it's essentially a meat and three. And it's where vegetables are cooked with meat, and, you know, you just can't, if you don't eat meat, you can't find very much there to eat. What? The Shuffletown Drive-In.
Shuffletown Drive-In?
Where is that? In Shuffletown. Mountain Island Lake.
How many of you eat? I have to keep asking these questions. How many of you actually would seek out a meat and three place? Is that the way you like to eat? Oh, so a lot of you. So you've got to keep these places going by, you know, going there, unfortunately.
Yeah, Penny just made a great point, too. I mean, what's happened is you've got better restaurants doing the same concept. Yeah. Like, she has a meat and two.
Yeah, we're pretty much meat and two, so...
Yeah, and that was just sort of people just called them meat and threes because that was the deal. And that's where you had this long list of vegetables, among which was banana pudding.
Well, that was the whole point behind dishes. I couldn't find vegetables that were not fried. That's where this whole concept came about for Dish. And basically so I'd have somewhere to eat. So,
yeah. There you go. All right, we see, who's got the mic? Here it is. Okay. Wait, which one is on? Okay, go ahead.
We touched on grilled Krispy Kremes, and we touched on barbecue. And the other night I went to a party, and there were grilled Krispy Kremes that you put the barbecue on, the pulled pork, with a drizzle of barbecue sauce over it, and it was amazing.
Some of these things, you know, remember, just because something doesn't exist, you know, we're easily defined now,
and a year from now, it can very well be on everybody's menu. These ideas come, something that was good once will come back. Things do cycle back. Okay, up there we have one.
I was just going to comment on when I was growing up, my favorite restaurant was the Venus on East Boulevard, and they had the best fried chicken with little packets and of honey, and you would dip the chicken in the honey. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's why, you know, it's not there anymore, because we don't eat that way anymore.
Honey dipped chicken is really good.
And the Drum was another great restaurant on East Boulevard, which is where, then it became Porcupine Provisions, and now it's the Deck. Yeah, but it still looks like a Drum, the building.
The Drum, yeah. Yeah, we only have what a couple of fried chicken places left, Prices, and then the chains. Over here? Yeah, we're going back to the side.
Hi. Okay, I have two questions. The first one is, I'm a vegetarian, but I used to love barbecue back 10 years ago when I could eat it. And I'm trying to figure out, how can I even attempt to get something similar? Like, tofu with barbecue sauce, I've tried. I have tried everything on the planet. And I have no way of figuring out how to get that same kind of barbecue flavor into a vegetable.
But hopefully we have the answer.
Yes. And I want to say that I love good food. Remember, I grew up on the traditional Southern soul food. So I love good food. And I still love good food, and I eat good food. We have I use a product now, if I'm allowed to say that. This product that I use, I used to use it in my restaurant, and it's called Match Meats. And it is a soy substitute made with soy and wheat gluten. But this is the best stuff I've ever had, better than a Boca or a Quorn or anything like that. And I've tried all of those. And they do the meat products, they're raw products, and they make them in pork flavor, chicken flavor, sausage, Italian sausage, chicken. So I make grilled chicken, breast herb chicken. I make fried chicken from it. I make pulled pork, and I have to give you the recipe. Yes. You come to me afterwards, and I will tell you the recipe for this pulled pork and this. And basically, everything that we're doing in terms of the foods that we're talking about eating, the Southern foods, it's all in the seasonings. We're looking for that taste. That's what you just said. You're looking for the taste. When we're talking about barbecue, everybody has a different style of maybe the barbecue, but it's really in the sauce. And that's what regions are known for. They are different types of sauce. So it's really in the seasonings. That's what we're looking for, that taste. Because if you took just barbecue, a plain rib, and you put it in boiling water and just put some salt and pepper in it, and I don't care what part of the pork you taste, you're not going to like it as well as if you smoke it, you barbecue it, you grill
rub it.
You
put some rub on it.
Exactly. Yeah. You got to put some rub on it. You got to put those kind of things on it. So, yeah, you can make, it's all in the seasonings. And you can't just take a pack of tofu and bake it in the oven and put some seasonings on it. And you got to have that food that they make with the wheat gluten so you can get that texture. Because remember, we're getting the taste and the feel that we want. So you can definitely do that. I do all of that. I have pork chops, chicken, barbecue, pulled pork, everything.
This might be a good point, time to mention that a lot of the things, like, for instance, getting recipes or being able to follow up tonight, WFAE, the website, will have links to everybody's blogs or websites so that you can stay in communication. Right? They can reach you that way.
Yes.
So that you'll be able to find Denise, continue that conversation. So just, Paul, you'll talk about that a little bit later, right? So we'll give you that information at the end of the evening. Okay, who's got the mic?
Hi, hey, Penny.
Hey, Lisa.
Like Penny, I'm an eater, not a cooker. And I was one of the, I think, two people that raised their hand and said, I don't cook. But I was lucky enough to marry a Greek. And so we have this good melding of Southern and Greek, which leads me back to the Meat and Three and the Greek diners. So the Diamond restaurant, you mm-hmm. didn't mention when you mentioned all these great diners, but is coming back and is coming back as a Greek diner.
Wow.
Where?
Soon. So it's in Plaza Midwood. If you've never been, it was opened in 1945 and is going to come back as a traditional Greek diner.
In the same place?
Yes, in the same place.
Yeah. This is excellent news.
It's just right around the corner from Dish.
Yeah, right around the corner from Dish. Yeah. We're in Plaza Midwood with Penny and lots of other great restaurants too. Yeah.
Diners are coming back. That's one of those.
They are coming back.
That's a great example of something that's coming back.
When I'm a native Charlottean. I grew up here. I met my husband here. I was obsessed with Greek boys because when I was growing up here in Charlotte in the 60s and 70s, Greeks were the second largest minority in Charlotte, believe it or not. There were African Americans and there were Greeks, and there were so many great Greek restaurants that we've lost. And that's something we feel really strongly about bringing those back, that Greek Southern tradition, which we live and breathe every day. So I want to let you guys know that it's coming.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else got the mic? Who's up?
Oh,
we want to make sure we get as many of you get your chance to talk. Go ahead.
I guess it's me already. I have to throw something out there. I grew up in New Jersey. And my New Jersey grandmother was a great cook, and she made pound cake and rice pudding and bread pudding. I'll give you banana pudding. But I thought that pound cake was a uniquely northern dessert. And I also have to put in a plug that the Greek Diner is a New Jersey institution. I mean, they still... New Jersey is still covered with Greek diners, and the first diner was in Connecticut, really.
That's right. That's a very good point, that what we often associate with as our own regional sort of thing, actually, we don't know that it exists in other places, so we assume it's ours. John T. Edge, who's really one of the great Southern food writers, maybe the most well-known food writer from the South who writes in a great sort of Southern voice, wrote a book a few years ago on fried chicken. The whole book was about fried chicken. I don't know if any of you read it, but we had him on Charlotte Talks talking about this. And the question he raised was he said, is there such a thing as Southern fried chicken? Everyone assumed that Southern fried chicken was specifically a Southern thing. And he says, it turns out that it's not. That, again, like this, it doesn't exist only, fried chicken doesn't exist anywhere, only here. It exists everywhere. And it's just called fried chicken, and that the franchise Southern fried chicken really doesn't necessarily belong to the South, but we think it does. When you live down here, you think it does because we associate it with fried cooking, which is associated with here. So there's a lot of, I think, the modern age of media communications has broken down some of those walls. We begin to become aware, and at the same time, we have such a strong need to associate with the community where we find ourselves living that we can create almost a myth around the things that we love because it's important to us. It's not false to do it. It's a way that we socialize, and it's a way that we can interact with each other and have pride in what we do and where we live. So these are not bad, or there's no value judgments on this. It's just sort of, I think, important to have this perspective to realize that, yeah, if you're from the North, a lot of the things that were up there exist down here as well. Microphone here.
I'm wondering if we can talk grits. I love grits, and I was wondering what's the story on grits? How did they get started? I've lived all over the United States, and you can't even get grits hardly anywhere except here. And
that's
what
New Jersey can't claim, right?
Yeah.
All right, you're not going to claim Jersey. Any background on grits?
I don't know how they got started.
I'm sure it was a way to use corn.
Yeah.
Hominy is not specifically on only exclusively Southern, obviously. Hominy is a big part of Mexican cooking and everything else. But hominy grits, as we know, and hominy means, and Fred Opie's book is called Hominy, Hogs and Hominy. So hominy is a big part of the cultural identity of Southern cooking. And it's a method. Hominy grits is a method of alkalizing corn so that the skins will release and it makes it more digestible. It's a technique that grew out of an era, again, when we didn't have all the mechanization and refrigeration that we have today, and it softened corn to make it available. Now, why is it associated with the South and our style of cooking? I'm not sure. I mean, again, it may have been...
Peter, we'll find out.
Native Americans, I think, created that style of the way they processed the corn and made it into the hominy and then the grits. And the same thing with the barbecue. It's just Spanish brought the concept over of the pit, the fire pit and the barbecue, and Native Americans, the American Indians, started using that first. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things that the Native Americans were doing that African Americans then started doing, and it went on and on and on from there, and Southerners start doing. So I think that's a concept that anybody can check on that and let me know if I'm wrong, but I think that was a Native American technique in terms of processing the corn.
The hominy part of it. Yeah,
the
hominy. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that.
Yeah.
And Native American, not just locally, but across
exactly.
the southeast, southwest.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. More microphones. Okay, we got one here.
Hi. Excuse me. You were talking about the fake meat going into the barbecue and stuff like that. Now, I've always sort of thought that Southern food and soul food were first of all food. But by the time you have these processed corn stuff with the wheat gluten holding it together and the various corn derivatives that you're going to have to get that, is that really still food? I mean, it seems like one step forward.
Sounds
and
like
you
step
know,
back. There's a little edge to that question.
You know,
huh?
Yeah. He said the processed food and the way, and not processed because most of what we eat nowadays is processed, and it's processed in some kind of way. The reason that we, and I always say this to people, that we're not eating the same foods that our grandparents ate. Even though it looks the same and it may taste the same or kind of, and you may feel the same, it's not the same food. Our grandparents, as somebody talked about, first of all, they had their own farms or gardens. They produced their own food right there. It was within reach, walking distance. They could go to where their food was that they produced. They raised their own cows and their own cattle, and they slaughtered them. They smoked them. They processed them on their own. And there was no such thing as bottled water back then, so we didn't have to do that. And like they talked about those type of things. And so the food is different, and they didn't raise the animals, and they weren't shot with hormones and antibiotics and things like that, just like the foods were not processed with a lot of chemicals, and you didn't have to have organic. So the foods are not the same as our parents, our grandparents and great-grandparents had, even though it looks the same. And so in terms of what you're saying with the processed food, it's just a soybean. It's a plant. And so you're taking a plant, a soybean, and soy has been around forever. And so they're taking this plant, and it used to be very popular. It was a staple, and so people used soy products a lot in school systems and places like that. And so they started taking the soybean, and they made it. And yeah, you mix it with the wheat gluten just for the consistency, and then and the rest is seasonings. And you just like our foods, like I say, you can just boil a piece of pork. But you won't like it unless it's smoked or seasoned or grilled or fried, and it won't taste the same. So you do the same thing with the soy products. You take that soybean, you mix it with some wheat gluten for the texture, and just like we take the lard or the shortening, and we make it, and we fry it, and we braise it, and we barbecue it to be able to have the taste and the texture that we get. Because some people, before they barbecue, they may boil it a little bit, or they do, to have the taste and texture. So you do the same thing with the fake meat that you're saying. You do the same thing with the vegetarian products. But in the end, it's in the seasonings, and it's in the way you prepare it. And that's how you make it taste good, and you make it feel good, and you make it just like the meat products that you eat. When she was asking how can you have barbecue, well, it's in the sauce. When you put some barbecue on some soy products, you don't know that it's not barbecue if you get that texture, just like the McRib that they used to sell at McDonald's, or I don't know if they still do, the McRib. Well, the soy McRib will have the same taste and feel that McRib that you ate in McDonald's, which is close to something that people eat now. So it's really in the seasonings and the texture that you're getting it. So you can make it just like all of the... Trust me, I'm telling you, I do this all the time. And
ultimately,
it's good.
You do have to ask, especially a vegetarian has to ask the question, you know, where am I going to get my protein? And finding a way to weave, you know, vegetable products that are high in protein together so that they taste good, because people won't eat healthy food because it's healthy. They will only eat it, they'll only come back and eat it again and again if it tastes good.
Right.
And I think that's Denise's point, is it's really ultimately, regardless of your style of eating, it always comes back to flavor in the end.
Exactly.
We have one back here.
Since we were talking about grits, I want to bring it back, and I have a question about hominy and polenta. Is that where that comes from?
Polenta?
Polenta from hominy?
It comes from corn, but not hominy. Polenta itself is corn, is a coarsely ground corn meal that has not been treated with the hominy method, which is an alkaline or a lye bath. So it's actually, I believe, just pure ground corn meal. So it's a slightly different product in the same family.
and what we call polenta, and correct me if you have a different take on this, but what we call polenta, which is an Italian really name for a coarse, you know, cornmeal cooked almost like risotto, you know, cooked like into a cooked grain, is when it's coarsely ground as opposed to finely ground. So when it's finely ground, we call it cornmeal. And when it's got little bits, almost like the size of grits, but it's not been done in the hominy treatment, then we call it, marketing started to call it polenta because people associated that grind with the Italian polenta. Does that answer your question? Okay, good. We have one here.
Yes, Denise, you probably shouldn't listen to this, but I am born and raised in Charlotte, and I am the queen of home-battered fried onion rings. And we've kind of touched on a lot of things, but one of the things that I've seen in Charlotte that has absolutely just died, and I hate that Bayou Kitchen doesn't do it anymore, is the hand-battered fried okra. Now, if you're not from Charlotte, you probably get a little grossed out over the boiled okra, which is very hard to find in a restaurant. My husband will absolutely not touch it. He just thinks that's the grossest thing he's ever seen in his life. But, yeah, he's also a Yankee. But I have had a very hard time finding home-battered fried okra. In the restaurants, a lot of times with the meat and three, you see fried okra, but it's the pre-breaded. Mm-hmm. Then all they do is drop it in the fryer. Mm-hmm. But home breaded, like the onion rings, South 21, Bowling Alley, you know, all the good original places for home battered. And I was wondering if there was, if any of you are familiar with, being the fried queen that I am, I've not been able to find the true home-breaded fried okra. And you see it like at Gus's, you have the squash, but not necessarily. Now, Church's Fried Chicken used to do it, and Bayou Kitchen used to do it. But since Bayou has changed over, I can't find it.
Does anybody know? Heidi?
Yeah, I would say part of the reason for that is there are some people who probably do it as a special when okra's in season, but it's very labor intensive, and it's much cheaper to open a bag of frozen breaded okra and throw it in the fryer, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist to do that. So, you know, I don't know if somebody knows where you can find it.
Do you know a place where you can find it?
This is going to sound really crazy, but Shane's Rib Shack has the home breaded okra like that.
You writing this down?
Yeah.
What's
Shane's
it called?
Rib Shack.
Where's Shane's Rib Shack?
Well, there's the one on Harris Boulevard, right in University City.
Oh, yeah.
They have the incredible kind.
And is it breaded or battered?
It's battered. It's not breaded. It's not like the frozen stuff that you can find pre-breaded. Yes. It's battered.
Yeah.
She's talking about the cornmeal style battering. Is it kind of in that style?
It's really light. It's
very light.
It's like what you would make at home. Yeah.
Give it a try, then let WFAE know so we can get it out there on the website. You know? We're starting to run towards the end of the evening, and I want to get a couple more questions in, and then give the information that came up earlier about biscuits. So let's take Tina. You got one? Okay.
Okay. Hi. I like to bake a lot, as my friends who are with me know, and I've made a lot of cobblers in my time, and I've found there are three different types of ways to make the crust. And my question is one more quintessentially Southern than the other? Because they're all called, if you look for cobbler recipes, there's one type of recipe where you make a batter and pour it over your fruit. Then there's more what I would call a rustic pie crust that you put over the top of your pan that has the fruit in it. And the third way is more a biscuity type, but they're all called cobbler. Is one more Southern? All three taste good if you make them right. But
Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the batter is the more quintessentially.
Really, more than the biscuit style, huh?
I think so. The best cobbler recipe I've ever, you see, now everybody disagrees with me. But that's all right. Yeah. Yeah, right. My grandma.
Thank you. I think that's what it is. He said, according to who your grandma is. Because
right.
My grandma said you had to roll out that pie crust with your rolling pin, and you had to cut it like the dumplings, and you had to lay it over the top. That's right. You pricked it in, and you lay it crisscross. Yeah. That's there you go.
You grew up in Tennessee, though, right?
I'm sorry.
Where'd you grow up in Tennessee?
Yes.
See, so that's Tennessee cobbler, all right, yeah, you know. And there's North Carolina cobbler. Yeah, so much depends on where you're growing up, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so, yeah. But so maybe there isn't one authentic. There is a book, James Vilas has written a book. He's a local boy, and he wrote a book on cobblers and crisps and a whole bunch of things that might be worth checking that out. He might have a little bit of background on, like, but these are very regional. It's like the cornbread question. They're very regional, maybe even to the as regional as your neighborhood. And I think often that it boils down to that. Let's take one more. We got one in the back here.
Would you say that sweet iced tea is uniquely Southern?
Yeah, good question. All right, what's your take on that?
Yeah,
huh?
Sweet iced tea is the wine of the South. So,
I certainly don't see that in the North or in California. Not the way we see it down here. Not as a cultural phenomenon, you know.
Yes. Yeah. No. Jane and Michael Stern, do you all know who they are? The people were in Charlotte, have been in Charlotte a lot. And I took them to the coffee cup to eat there when the coffee cup was the original coffee cup. And she said, I just have to know how they do this. I can't do it anywhere else. So I think it is.
Interesting, yeah. The way we do it. Well, that's a great note to sort of tie things together. I just want to address the biscuit question, because we do have a box of biscuits in the back for people to try. And these are not Bojangles-style biscuits. They're not the biscuits that I think of as distinctively biscuits of this area. These are a biscuit that's made with some of you may have seen me do this biscuit on the Channel 14 News thing where we have the Johnson & Wales segments. I did it. It's a lamination technique where you actually cut butter in like you're making pie dough into the biscuit. So that's very much like biscuits. At that stage, when you add your buttermilk or milk or cream to it, you have a wet batter, and you could drop those biscuits. That would be what I would think of as a more sort of a Southern-style drop biscuit. But what I do is I roll it out in flour and then fold it 3 times, like I'm making croissants, and roll it out and fold it again, and roll it out and fold it again. There's a couple folks here from the community culinary school, and every time we do a biscuit class or a baking class there, we make these, and we can even fold in cheese if you want on each of the rollouts. Marilyn's had them. And then what we do is each time we roll it, the dough gets a little firmer, a little stiffer, until you could finally, at the end, cut them with a biscuit cutter or a pizza knife into pieces that will stand up. And because you've rolled them and the butter, the little pieces of butter are in there creating layers of sort of weak spots, when it bakes, they puff. So it's kind of almost like a little puff pastry biscuit combo. So what you should taste, and again, these aren't fresh because they're fresh but they weren't right out of the oven where they're real flaky. So the flakiness is kind of faded away, but what you should taste is the butteriness. And so and again, this is one of many ways to do biscuits. It's a biscuit that I felt I could do without getting my next door neighbor really mad at me because it's not like her, but it's a totally different thing than hers. And so we still get along really, really well.
Her recipe,
she hasn't given it. It's a family recipe, but it's very similar to the recipe that Shirley Corrier is famous for, which she calls, I think, angel biscuits. And so it's a drop biscuit, and they're baked in the pan all next to each other, and they grow into a pan, and they're very, very light and flaky. Many of you probably make biscuits just as good, but just don't tell her. How about a round of thanks for our panel tonight? Thank you. Yeah. And of course, we just scratched the surface, you know, of the subject. It's just really an excuse to get us all together and hang out. A special thanks to Mark Rumsey for sort of producing and putting this whole thing together, and Aaron Sutton is co-producing tonight. You all know their names. And I want to introduce Paul Stribling, who is the program director at WFA. He's going to tell us a few things and kind of wrap us up tonight. Okay, thanks.
I'm going to start by saying, how about an extra warm round of applause for Peter Reinhardt?